Good morning and welcome to the weekend on One. Sarah McInerney here with you again this weekend, and I hope you're all having a wonderful weekend thus far. We're going to start the show with a look at some of what it says in the Sunday newspapers. And we'll take a look at the Business Post. Its headline is Irish health authorities predict 1.9 million people will fall ill with coronavirus. This is a story by Susan Mitchell, and she has spoken to senior health officials who are basing that figure on modelling, which is almost complete according to the story, that suggests that 40% of the population will be sick with COVID-19. The paper also has a story on the front about the K Club. It's going to rename the golf course. It has obviously been called the K Club since it opened in 1991, and now apparently it's going to be rebranded as the Strachan Golf Course and Club. So everything changes and everything stays the same. The Sunday Independent, virus, faster sick pay is on the cards. And this is a story about a cabinet subcommittee meeting that is due to take place this week. They're going to be talking about what to do for workers who may be told to stay home. At the moment, they don't get sick pay for the first 6 days, but apparently it's going to be under consideration to ban that to getting sick pay immediately. The Sunday Times then, HSE axes nurse hire embargo to cope with the virus. This is the comments from Philney Hay, the General Secretary of the INMO, yesterday. She said that the HSE had told her that it had lifted an embargo, which apparently there wasn't in the first place. But anyway, it has lifted the embargo that never was on hiring professional medical personnel. And it also is a story about a man, Ben Kavanagh, who was working in Wuhan. He has returned home to Ireland. He was in quarantine, and he's saying that he doesn't think Europe is taking the coronavirus seriously enough in comparison to what he saw, the measures that he saw taking place over in China. There's a story as well on the front page of the Sunday Times by Stephen O'Brien. O'Callaghan urged to oust leader Martin. Jim O'Callaghan, the Fianna Fáil Justice spokesman, has come under pressure, says the story, from some parliamentary party colleagues to make a move against Micheál Martin's leadership. But it says the lack of support means no challenger is expected to emerge. The Irish, the Mail on Sunday then reports that Fianna Fáil TD John Lahart has called for a temporary national government to deal with the COVID-19 threat. The Sunday World has a story about cab seizures. The Irish Sunday Mirror and the Sun on Sunday also lead with the COVID story and the various different difficulties being faced by the authorities in relation to that. The Observer actually has an interesting story from Britain, also about COVID-19. It's on the front of all the papers, folks. There is no getting away from it. But it is reporting that a range of drastic new measures, including emergency legislation that would allow people to switch jobs and volunteer to work in the NHS or in care homes, are being drawn up by ministers in an attempt to tackle the coronavirus. And you do wonder how many of these measures that we're seeing all in the various other European countries, how many of these measures are going to have to be considered here? Well, to answer some of those questions, we have an excellent panel for you this morning. I'm joined this morning by Peter Power, Executive Director with UNICEF and also former Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. Dr. Chris Luke, Emergency Physician and Adjunct Senior Lecturer in Public Health at UCC. Noreen Hegarty, Global Vice President Digital for Lonely Planet. Lise Hand, the journalist, and Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs and also a columnist with Independent Newspapers. And I might start with you, Chris, because as I say, COVID-19 everywhere across the papers and also a lot of different numbers about what we can expect to happen here and how serious this is going to get. And that figure, obviously, on the front of the Sunday Business Post, 1.9 million people might get sick. What number do we believe at this point?
Well, the problem, Sarah, is that we've been wrong so often in the past in terms of our predictions. For example, with foot and mouth and with Ebola and with avian flu, we don't have a very good track record in terms of the epidemiology, which is basically the mathematical mapping of disease spread. But the figures that we're beginning to crystallise around our predictions at the moment are that about 40% of the Irish population will be affected by the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. Now, that the margin of error is between 30 million and or 30% and 50%. So there's a huge margin of error there, as you can imagine. And the other figures that we are kind of agonising over are the figures that reflect the capacity in the health service. So there's a piece in the Mail on page 4 about our intensive care capacity, which says that there may be up to 6,000 acute cases of COVID disease, which are so severe in terms of pneumonia and multi-organ failure that they will need intensive care. And that is in the context of the existing capacity of 250 ICU beds.
So, and is that the key then in terms of that 1.9 million figure? You're saying that's based on the 40% of the population,
yes,
idea.
Those
people, while they may get sick, a lot of them won't be very sick.
Yeah.
Could we take that?
I think it's very important to actually listen to the experts in all corners of the world. I mean, one of the great benefits of the coronavirus epidemic, and I think there will be many benefits, is that there is a harmonising of research and other academic efforts in terms of dealing with and researching the virus and its mode of contagion. And I read a piece yesterday talking about the Wuhan epicentre, which suggested that while there was a very high mortality, relatively speaking, within the Wuhan and Hubei province, that Wuhan, that the mortality was as low as 0.7%. So these figures are very much in evolution, and I tend to be more optimistic than many people, because I suppose I've spent, you know, 35 years in an emergency department, and you can't keep saying, you know, oh, Captain Mannering, we're doomed. You know, you just have to get on with the reality. And I'm also anxious that we don't overstate the risks here, because we're dealing with human beings, not just patients, but also staff. And, you know, it's very, very important when we're discussing this whole issue that we don't strike fear into the heart of all our staff, because we need them to continue with their faith and fortitude working in all our hospitals, and we need to be right behind them. So at the moment, I'm opting for the more optimistic figure of 1% or less mortality.
All right. But I do want to ask you about that figure that you talked about there in the Daily Mail, page 4, about up to 6,000 acute cases expected and 250 ICU beds, and obviously those maths don't work.
Yeah.
Do we have, in your view, do we have enough ICU beds, even if that figure of 6,000, we don't know, as you say, in terms of how the disease is developing, but 250 ICU beds does seem...
No,
low.
I mean, I actually wrote one of the first trauma guidelines in Ireland for the College of Surgeons in 2003. And even back then, we were talking about the massive dearth of intensive care unit beds. I mean, we probably have about a third to a quarter of the number of intensive care unit beds that they have around Europe. But, you know we have an understaffed and an overcapacity, in a sense, emergency department, where we have bed occupancy of about 110%. So we know we have that, but listen, guys, we're now in the midst of battle. We're about to engage with the enemy, so now is the time to stop with the analysis, and now is time to respond effectively. So, although I've been a dissenter for years in terms of provision of healthcare and facilities and staffing, there comes a point in dealing with any emergency when you say, "Look, let's just get on with it. Let's stop talking and let's just deal with it."
Peter, you were looking. Speaking of dealing with it and how do we deal with it, you were looking at the Sunday Independent page 5, a piece by Ciara Kelly about how it's time. What is a contagion risk means? It's time to back the collective good over individualism.
Yes, an excellent article, I have to say, by Dr. Ciara Kelly on this. So she points initially to the really incredible fact that young people under 20 years of age, seem to be almost immune. They're not immune, but they're almost unaffected by this. And the mortality rate around the world, certainly from our figures, suggest that it is almost negligible. So that raises very interesting questions. Therefore, the mortality rate, if it averages out at what, 2 point something percent, it's going to be higher and much, much higher in older people. And that raises fundamental questions about the social contract we have in Ireland. And yes, Ciara and to another extent, Brendan O'Connor on page 1 of The Independent raised this issue about whether we need a moment of national solidarity, that we need to accept that we have responsibility to each other as individuals, as workmates. And that's why I'm sure we'll talk about the economic aspects of this in terms of whether people should be forced to stay at home, to what extent they can be compelled to stay at home, sick pay, illness pay, all that sort of thing. But the contract between the state and the individual needs to be really examined here. The state needs to step up here, not just in terms of health services, but providing support for individuals, for businesses, right across the board. And I think we need to, we're at an inflection moment, I think, in the sense that we need to reflect carefully on this and what it means to be a citizen of this country and what it means to have a social contract with each other and with government. And I think there are issues that are going to play out over the next few weeks. It's going to be very interesting.
Noreen?
Yeah, I defer to Chris and to the medical experts on the numbers. I'm no expert on that. But I have to note with irony that the story we're referring to in the Mail about the 6,000 acute cases for 250 ICU beds is topped by a photograph of 18 Italian tourists who are in Dublin for the weekend. And I think that, you know, I'm in a company, Lonely Planet. We travel all the time. We have a company-wide global ban on travel for the month of March until we assess the situation. And we're not alone. Most of the multinationals, I was at the American Chamber Transatlantic Conference on Thursday, and nearly all of the people I met from all of the multinationals and foreign direct investment have all imposed these bans for the moment to be responsible and to be precautionary. But we haven't imposed a ban on people coming in. And there are still flights going to and from North Italy, direct from Dublin and from all other European cities at the moment. And I think you have to look at the experience of somewhere like Singapore that has managed really well to contain this over the last 6 weeks. They've had 130 cases, 82 people have recovered. They've kind of the same population as us. They're around the 5.5 million mark. And they've imposed really strict rules about restrictions on people travelling. For them, particularly, it's South Korea and China. But they have imposed, you know, a couple who gave a false travel history are being criminally charged. Somebody else has lost their residency permit because they've broken quarantine. But by imposing really strict and what would seem to be draconian measures, they have managed to contain it. And I think that is the objective for Ireland, particularly as an island nation, because the damage, and I know we'll talk about it more, but the damage in terms of tourism, where we've 11 million tourists coming in each year, and the damage in terms of business, the hospitality trade, it's in the newspapers today, you know, restaurants are suffering, you know, there's already an impact being felt. So the shorter period that we can make this, surely that's the better. So I'm of the school that says I'd rather have too much too soon than too little too late.
Any thoughts on that, Dan?
Yeah, well, I'm paying a lot of attention to what's going on in Italy because I think that's the country that we're going to be most like. It's another European country, more or less the same temperature. I wonder with Singapore, potentially, it's right in the equator. If heat is an issue there, then Italy will definitely be closer. They're much more advanced in terms of people dead relative to the size of the population and reported cases relative to the population. They are now worse than China. So they have been doing a lot more overnight. They closed down the entire region of Lombardy and some other regions under quarantine, but it's still spreading. So they have taken some pretty tough measures.
But they are still travelling. What do you make of what Noreen is saying? Because I know Simon Harris, is the health minister, has addressed this and said if we ban flights directly from Italy, they may come through, you know, other airports and there's no way of containing it. Although you may have heard in the headlines there the Czech Prime Minister saying they want Italy to say stop travelling to citizens.
I was in contact with a friend in Bergamo, a town outside Milan, just this morning. And she was able to book a flight. And flights are coming in and out of Milan airports to Dublin. Now, if the authorities in Lombardy are imposing a quarantine, how are people coming in and out of Milan airports? It's not quite clear what's going on there. But people in Italy are increasingly worried. You know, one of the big Italian newspapers, the 24-Hour Sun in English, is talking about the need to requisition hotels for intensive care or for at least isolation. One of the other papers is talking about in intensive care units saying that people over 75 won't be taken in. Because it'll if it comes down to a case of who's most likely to survive, and this has been touched on earlier, the very positive thing is that younger people are not affected. The really worrying thing for all of us with older loved ones, it is a very serious thing if older people get it. The mortality rates are, you know, worryingly high for older people.
And Chris, that goes back to the idea, I suppose, of how the health services here might cope. Again, we see initially they're not coping. Now, Italy is a unique case thus far, thank God, in that it has exploded in Italy in a way that it hasn't anywhere else in Europe. But could you see those sort of measures having to be taken here? Or what sort of measures could you see having to be taken here if we go to the numbers that are expected?
Well, I think Dan and Peter and Noreen have very eloquently identified the issues. I mean, basically, there are three contagions that we have to deal with here. There's the virus per se, but there are also the contagions of fear and anger. Now, anger is what happens when people lose their jobs en masse and their livelihoods. Fear is what we've seen already. It's the contagion that has already arrived with people, and their shopping trolleys full of loo rolls. And then there's the virus itself. So one of the advantages of procrastination, it's a paradoxical advantage of procrastination, which some people are accusing our government of, is that we are now able to kind of select the best and the nearest and most useful model. I mean, Dan's mentioned the issue of temperature and climate and geography in relation to Singapore and Italy. And I've read about Singapore and I've been to Singapore, actually, and they're very, very businesslike people. I think he's absolutely right. So now is actually, and I think we need to calibrate really progressively, steadily upwards. I think we're now about 4 or 5 on the dial of alertness. And at the same time, we have to be careful about being over-alarmed. But we are facing into really, really historically decisive decision, considerations, such as triaging the young as opposed to the old, the relatively young as opposed to the relatively old. Dealing with the fact that
what do you mean by that? Do you mean?
Well, I mean, Peter has raised the issue of, are we going to say, right, we have too few intensive care unit beds and hospitals to deal with the vast numbers of very, very sick, moribund people over the age of 75 and 80. And at the same time, we have hundreds of people who are in their 40s and 50s at their peak productivity in terms of the state and the social contract, which he mentioned. So, are we going to prioritise intensive unit care of the young and productive as opposed to those who are elderly?
And you think that's a discussion that needs to be had now?
I think one of the advantages of this coronavirus epidemic is that we are now having to have really very difficult discussions that we have put off for years and years about capacity, about the social contract, and about the fact that we're all living longer and longer and we haven't got enough nursing home beds and never mind intensive care unit beds.
Lise, on the whole idea then that Chris mentioned there of the spread of rumour and fear, as well as the spread of the virus, you were looking at a piece by Mark Tye in the Sunday Times page 6 about that. How do you think that's all being handled?
Well, you see, this is again, it's such a rapidly unfolding situation that you have this, I suppose, tension between the need to know and people's desire to know and the government and the health services' desire to protect individuals' privacy and not to have people, highlighted for a medical condition. And I think what's happening is you have old rules but applied to a very new globalised world that is dominated by social media. So a lot, perhaps, of the practices to protect people's privacy or to maybe, put a lid on some information that would have worked in pre-social media days don't work anymore. They just don't, because we've seen this already where, an outbreak will happen and the name of the school, say, for instance, was up on social media beforehand. And this creates, and the dangerous thing with this, of course, is that it creates an atmosphere of mistrust, because people don't know if they're getting all the information, if things are being concealed from them, or if, people are being upfront. I mean, there was a second piece, actually, that you, your good self, wrote in the Sunday Times, and you referenced, and I thought it was quite interesting, the sort of atmosphere of panic that surrounded the bank crash. And everybody had heard the rumours that, that the IMF were coming in and the bank runs that were taking place. And it took an outsider to come in, Patrick Holohan, the then governor of the central bank, to come in, go on Morning Ireland, do a completely solo run and just lay out the facts to people. Mm. And it had the opposite effect that the government probably thought, because it actually calmed people down, because they felt that somebody was levelling with them, telling them exactly what was going on. And people trusted what they heard from him. So, this sort of atmosphere of, if anybody's impression that there's a sort of an air of secrecy around things, that just is that's the void into which rushes all the kind of tinfoil hat conspiracy theories and all the false information on social media. We saw that piece that purported to be from Clare FM that went up on social media, that wasn't from Clare FM, that basically said every school in Clare had shut down and caused immense trouble. So, I think it's very important that the government and various communication, the communications departments of all the relevant organisations get organised, A, to kind of quell any false rumours that go around, but just to make people feel that they are being provided with information. I think that's really key.
Yeah. What do you think of that, Peter? Because I was struck by Paul Reid on The Late Late Show on Friday night. He was speaking to Ryan Tuberty, and Paul Reid said that that's the head of the HSE. He said, we're exactly where we thought we'd be in terms of the numbers at this point. And then Ryan Tuberty said to him, well, if you know where we are now, then obviously you'll know where we'll be next week. And Paul Reid wouldn't tell him where we'd be next week. And Ryan Tuberty asked him two or three times, and Paul Reid didn't give us the number. And I just wondered, is that the sort of thing that makes people... Because it was obvious we weren't being told. But at the same time, I can understand the HSE and the department and the government is trying to balance too much information and everybody panicking. So how do you hit that balance?
Yeah, I mean, people can take different things from that interview. I listened and watched carefully to that interview, and I thought actually, indeed, he was a model of clarity and he was calm. It suggested to me that somebody was very much in control of the situation. And as Lise said, there's information coming from all quarters, but we should at this very important national moment really take our guidance from the real experts, including the chief medical officer. And that's not happening in some other countries, I should add. But there is a wider perspective to this era, I would say, that we should keep cognizance of. And that is, I've no doubt we will look back on this incident as being a major moment in time. It is a severe threat to especially elderly people, as we say. But when you look at the wider global perspective, more children died last year in the world of a completely curable and preventable disease called measles than will ever die, in my opinion, from COVID-19. Coronavirus. We will get a vaccine to this. We will move on. I don't doubt our human capacity to solve this. But we also need to keep a bit of perspective about the whole situation. And we need not to sort of like have this, you know, groupthink or global panic around this when there are actually bigger problems. I mean, more people are going to die in the Syrian crisis in the next 7 days, then we'll die of COVID-19. So there are big global issues here, but we need to keep perspective.
And we will be returning, actually. We're going to be talking about the Syrian crisis in quite a bit more detail later in the show. Noreen, your thoughts?
Yeah, to Lisa's point in relation to communication, I think Dr. Tony Holohan has been exemplary in terms of being reassuring and calm and giving information. My concern is that we're in a social media age. And while we can dismiss and say all the conspiracy theories are out there and all the craziness and all the hysteria and everything else, the reality is there's a huge cohort of people, honestly, probably not even listening to this show today, who get their information from social media. That's where their news feeds come from. And rather than sort of pointing the finger and saying, you know, this is not the right way to do it, I think we need to harness it better. And my concern about Paul Reid and Dr. Tony Holohan is social media is moving ahead of them, and the rumours are out there and the information is out there. And then once a day we get an update on things. We're in a 24/7 environment, and I think we need to be much more proactive in taking control of the message in social media to keep people calm and to keep them informed, rather than leaving it to WhatsApp groups and to, you know, Twitter or to Facebook feeds or whatever else it is, because I think that's where at the moment an awful lot of people are getting their information. It's not from what we regard as kind of mainstream media. And we saw that in the recent general election.
Can you tackle it?
I think you take control of it. I think you've got to be, you know, once a day briefings are not enough. You've got to be much more proactive in terms of giving information in a speedy way.
All right. Dan, you're looking at the economic impact of this. You have a piece in it today, and there are a number of other pieces as well looking at that. Tell us about where you think we're at. I know the Financial Times yesterday was talking about global recession, or possibly.
Yeah, look, you know, so first of all, I think we all agree that this is not sort of some Hollywood apocalypse sort of thing. The death rate for this overall is very low. So, you know, a year from now, it's not, the world will not have come to an end. That's absolutely, I think everyone absolutely agrees on that. But one of the things is that to slow it down and push out the infection rate so that we have less stress in the hospitals and the hospitals can deal with it more easily will mean doing things that are going to slow the economy. And there's a possibility that we end up going into a recession. Now, when you have a recession, there's less money available to the state to pay for the things that are going to be needed. And that is obviously a concern, that if we go into a global recession and the economy turns down and the tax revenues are not going to government to be able to fight this, that we both have a health crisis and an economic crisis together. And they are things you don't want to have. You don't want to have either of them, but having them together could be very serious for society, for politics, would be a very bad situation.
So how close are we to that, or can we avoid it?
It is really difficult. You know, I say this all the time. Economists are useless at predicting the future, even in normal times. This is, at this stage, I think we are in unprecedented territory already with this. How it's going to affect the economy, how it affects with people's willingness to spend. You know, if it has a real shock effect on people's willingness to go about their daily lives and spend money, the economy then goes into starts contracting. And, you know, we need to do everything we can, and I'm sort of outlining some of those thoughts in today's column, to stimulate the economy now. Now is the time for government action to stimulate things.
Like what?
So one thing is that many companies will have a VAT bill coming due over the next couple of weeks. They'll have to pay their VAT for their sales in January and February. A lot of small businesses, particularly in the hospitality sector, have already seen a drop-off in trade. I'm saying allow companies to defer the payment of VAT so they keep their cash flow going. Instead of giving that tax, handing that tax over to the tax man, they keep that money and they allow it to pay their staff and pay their suppliers to keep the economy going. So it's just one thought that could possibly be done to keep cash flow going within the economy.
Noreen, I suppose an example of some of the stresses on the economy is there on the front page of the Sunday Independent. You were looking at that story about sick pay and the government meeting tomorrow, or a cabinet subcommittee at least meeting tomorrow, to look at whether or not workers who are being told to stay at home should be given sick pay immediately. But that's no small decision, is it? Especially when you're telling potentially 1.9 million workers. Well, no, I mean, it's not going to be 1.9 million, but we don't know how many it will be.
And the other issue is sick pay is, I think, 193 euro a week or something like that, which for most people will be a lot less than they would get normally. And in an environment where we have a gig economy, I mean, I think a third of the workers in America are on 0 hours contracts or in a gig economy. Will people stay at home when they're sick in a situation that it is a pandemic or not? And I think there are major considerations in that regard. And to Dan's point in relation to, you know, the global recession, there's been enormous complacency in the United States about this. I mean, it seems to be running out of control, and that's the biggest economy. You know, you hear on the, there was a rally for Trump in North Carolina earlier in the week where people were saying it's a Democrat-inspired hoax. There's no such thing as coronavirus or COVID-19. And then you have, on the other hand, you know, Trump sort of essentially downplaying it. So I think different countries are responding in different ways, and I think that's a huge factor in terms of the global response to it. I mean, they reckon that Italy is going to be down 9 million tourists in the next 3 months alone. Mm-hmm. The Italian economy is fragile at the best of times. That's a massive impact. So I wonder, are we hurtling into...
Well, could I just jump back in? One of the other things is possibly increase unemployment benefit payments for a temporary period. Increase, as you said, you know, the illness benefit is quite low. Mm-hmm. You know, would the government consider bumping up the amount? Maybe in a voucher scheme way, that you, if you don't spend it, you lose it. That'll encourage people not to save the money, but to actually spend it. Just on a positive thing, 87% of people who are employed in Ireland are employed as employees, so they'll qualify for sick benefit. We have actually quite a small percentage of people who are self-employed in the gig economy. It's only 13% of people employed. So 87% of people have job contracts, are employees, and will qualify for sick benefit.
After the 6 days, or maybe immediately, depending on that decision.
Exactly.
And that is, Lise, one of so many big political decisions that are going to have to be made around all of this. Is our caretaker Taoiseach not the right person, I don't mean from a political perspective, but given the authority that he has at the moment, is that the right place for us to be as a country, to have a caretaker government?
No. We really, it's not the right place. I mean, this is the time where we do need to have a fully functioning government and a stable one as well, because there are so many decisions that may or may not have to be taken in terms of logistics, transport, economics, sport, every single aspect. And the trouble is, if you have a caretaker government, a caretaker Taoiseach, they aren't really able to make those big books decisions as well, because
is there any chance it is better because it sort of takes the politics out of it in a way, you know, because everybody knows they're not necessarily going to be the people in charge, so therefore it's a little apolitical.
Yeah, it should be apolitical, but you see, suppose if you have the three main parties of government, you know, of not government, distracted by these incredibly slow and prolonged government formation talks as well. It's, you know, it means their time is divided. I mean, it's quite interesting. There's a few pieces scattered across the various papers calls for a national unity government on a temporary basis. There's some suggestions it could be, I think Colm McQuilla has a piece in Sunday Business Post suggesting maybe for 2.5 years. The Mail on Sunday have a piece.
Yeah, John Lahart on the front page is talking for a national
which
unity
is
government.
Exactly. The headline is quite extraordinary. It's something like, get rally Sinn Féin to fight the coronavirus, to fight the corona. I don't know whether they mean with actual weapons or what. It's just a bit of a strange one. But you do have these, you do have these people saying, look, this is serious. Decisions have to be made that, that cannot be political. So the only way actually to deal with this is to have some kind of cross-party temporary government of unity where politics are put aside. I mean, we saw to it, obviously a lesser extent, but with the sort of the Brexit crisis where we did have, confidence and supply remaining in place probably longer than it should have because all parties felt that they had to stick together and the opposition parties basically rowing in, offering support to the government on the Brexit talks. So, there is a kind of a skeleton of a template, we'll call it there, for something like this, that in the interests of national unity, that all the basic disagreements between the parties could be put aside and they could say, we're just going to concentrate on, say, health and housing over the next while. We're going to get through this crisis and we're going to, put aside our ideological and political differences and work together. Now, having said that, when you actually look across the papers and the utter shambles that are going on within the various parties, I mean, there's all kinds of, infighting, backfighting, backstabbing, frontstabbing, and it's very hard to actually see where out of this sort of melee some kind of agreement for a national government of unity is going to spring. But having said that, if this does escalate, it's possible that the public will start getting incredibly angsty about this and saying, lads, get your act together. We need a stable government in there making the big decisions and we need all you guys to row in together. So what actually could end up being the catalyst towards a speedier formation of government could be the general public generally cheesed off with the situation.
Dan, how important is it, do you think?
I completely disagree with Liz on this.
Oh, excellent.
On the basis that I think a whole number of reasons. One, changing ministers now, I think we need a bit of stability to focus on the health crisis that's coming. Over the next 8 weeks, things are going to change a lot. There's going to be a lot of change, unprecedented change over the next few weeks. I think it's better to let the existing government handle that. And if they mishandle it, then there's a fresh start with 8 weeks with a new government. I think politically there's a reason to do it. And a third reason, I think it's impossible to draft a programme for government right now. We could be in recession in 8 weeks. You can't put a programme to government when there is so much uncertainty about the resources.
What about the national unity idea?
Well, I think that tends to, the idea for national unity government is possible. That usually happens when there's an external enemy, a wartime situation. Not sure that, not having an opposition would be particularly a good thing. I'm not, I don't feel strongly about it one way or the other. But I certainly think that we should the focus now should be on dealing with what's coming down the line.
Peter?
Well, I have to say I'm with Liz on the first aspect of this. I mean, I suppose speaking as a former minister, the one thing I can say with a good deal of certainty is that once the election is over and you're in that interregnum period, your political authority ebbs away very, very quickly. And the capacity to make decisive political initiatives leaves you. As as an individual, as an office holder, that happens.
You think it affects your mindset?
Oh, it does. It does. And you're in a caretaker role, and you're effectively an administrator. But we're in a crisis. We're facing a crisis, and in the medium term, the Brexit crisis has not gone away. The talks in Brussels are very worrying this year. So I have to be with Liz on this. The capacity of ministers to take bold initiatives, such as the things that Dan is saying about illness benefit, about VAT receipts, that requires, they are political decisions. So I think, the experienced people in the various political parties recognise this, and therefore they know, because a lot of them will have been in ministerial office before. So they will know this, and therefore there is a huge onus on the senior people in these parties to say, listen, we know the message of from the general election, and we have to take decisive action. The second point I'd make is this, is mathematics counts in all of this, arithmetic counts. And so one thing, and I know, you in the journalist box in the Dáil Chamber, you would have seen this, Sarah. There is a magic number, 80. And the figures in the dynamic that flows from the general election points to a number over 80. It's not rocket science. And we need a stable, coherent government that can deal with these big issues of health and housing over a 5-year period. That needs a government that can coalesce around 80 plus seats. It isn't rocket science. And they need to take the responsibility pretty quickly, as Lee said, or else the public will figure this out very quickly and will get very frustrated,
in my
view.
What about Dan's point then, that we are effectively in the emergency now? It's almost too late. We're in the emergency. We don't know what's going to happen with the economy for the programme for government, as Dan points out. And also, could it take people's attention away from what they should be focusing on, which is COVID?
Yeah, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, should we coalesce as a national government? I have my doubts about that, I have to say, because in my experience, when you get, you know, diverse views around the table at government, you know, all legitimate in their own right and all have a mandate from the people. But what you get then is fudges, political fudges. And we don't need fudges. The message in this general election, as I detect it, was people want very decisive, bold action. That can only come about from an agreed programme for government and not a fudge.
Noreen?
I fear that the government talks are going to be overtaken by events. And if we look at the situation currently, where we are in an unprecedented situation and the numbers exponentially are growing for infections. If that is the case, we'll know in the next 7 days or so if suddenly the numbers double again in Ireland and as to what the reaction is going to be then as well globally in terms of that. So I'm not sure that we have, you know, Eamon Ryan said during the week it was 70 days to create the last government and it could be longer this time. I'm not sure we have that amount of time before these events overtake us. And I think that is a concern. And the other element to this, the Greens are really central to whatever government is formed. And I think it's going to be a protracted discussion for it. And decisions will have to be made immediately. I mean, the one that is, you know, overwhelming at the moment is Patrick's Day Parade. What happens with that? And, you know, I can understand that there is a real concern from the part of business, from the part of tourism, in terms of the impact of that. But there's also a real concern that if 500,000 people are on the streets of Dublin, that it may be a petri dish for more infection, or as John Crown said to you yesterday, it's the you know, drinking and having fun and partying afterwards that could be more perilous. So I think things are going to move at a pretty, if we look at the experience of other countries, things could move at a pretty rapid pace now and there just won't be that 70 days or beyond it. So I think I would agree with Dan's viewpoint that we've just got to make quick decisions. We have never been in a situation like this historically. I mean, the 1918 Spanish flu is the one that's being used as a comparison. We need to make sure that we do everything we can to contain it and everything we can to recover as an island nation on the periphery of Europe as quickly as possible and ensure that, you know, our tourism and our business and our exports are all operating as best they can.
All right, you mentioned, well done for coughing into your elbow there,
exactly,
Chris. Yeah. Looking good. Example to you all if any of you are thinking about coughing. You mentioned St. Patrick's Day. I want to talk about that a little bit more and lots else that's in the newspapers today. Stay with us.
The Weekend on One on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at RTE Weekend on One.
Welcome back. My panel with me this morning, chatting away happily amongst themselves, are Peter Power, Chris Luke, Noreen Hegarty, Lee's Hand and Dan O'Brien. And Chris, I wanted to ask you about what Noreen Hegarty was talking about there just before the break about St. Patrick's Day and the decision at the moment to go ahead with it. John Crown was on the show yesterday saying he does not think that's a good idea specifically for cancer patients. What's your thoughts on it?
Well, I agree with what's been said already in terms of the economic impact and the fact that it's been a political process, this whole business of deciding whether or not to hold the St. Patrick's Day traditional celebrations. And I have to say, Sarah, that over the last day or two, I have been nudged towards the cancellation camp. Now, I'm also very keen to stick to the numbers. For example, there's an editorial in the Business Post about the need for trust and transparency in the fight against the virus. And they talk about how schools might accelerate the spread of flu-like illnesses. But so far, the coronavirus is not like the flu, and it turns out that school closures may not be useful. I'm not sure whether we haven't seen precedents. I'm a great fan of history and particularly in medicine, and I think there's all sorts of precedents we will remember in due course. And I often think of like typhus and typhoid and tuberculosis in the congested districts and the era of famine. A lot of the problem there arose because London and Dublin squabbled. And London and landlords and Dublin and landlords squabbled because there, so there wasn't there a unity of purpose and clear political benevolent decision making. So it was all very piecemeal. And therefore, those who suffered were those in the congested district and those in the coffin ships and so on. So there's no doubt that the next week or so will require a very clear political decision making. And as I say, it's at least as much political and economic as it is medical. But on balance, I'm afraid I have to say that I now think that we should probably cancel St. Patrick's Day. And of course, remember, there'll be benefits to the emergency departments in our hospitals because, you know, Paddy's Day is unfortunately one of those points in the year when there's a surge of activity ending up in the emergency departments.
All right, I want to move on unless anybody else has strong feelings about St. Patrick's Day. No,
I just make one small point. I think, you know, in terms of there is a tendency of governments to sort of think of the economy, but, you know, the economy is made up out of people. And, you know, so I think that, you know, the priority should be just to make sure everybody is okay. And again, going back to the trust and confidence thing as well, you know, if you have a look at all the multinationals who are here and all the tourists that are going to book holidays here, I think they'd be happier coming to a country that they know that if there's a crisis, they handle it well, efficiently and quickly. So by cancelling, it's actually counterintuitive, I think, but I think by cancelling something like the Paddy's Day celebrations, it actually shows that we're a responsible country prepared to deal with this. And actually that would probably, in the long run, and we have to think long run here, would probably actually encourage more people to feel safe about coming to Ireland, either for business or for leisure.
That is certainly an interesting perspective, Lisa, and you may well be right. Tell me, while I have you, about some of the other stories in around politics in the papers today. Stephen O'Brien, I mentioned earlier, has this story about Jim O'Callaghan being urged to oust Micheál Martin by some people, at least in the party, and quite a bit around Micheál Martin, isn't there, and the pressure that he's under.
There is. There's quite a lot of, and this really seems to have stemmed from an interview he gave with the station during the week. Micheál Martin was talking to Sean O'Rourke and basically opened the floodgates, as we used to love that expression always in politics, by saying, you know, yes, we stand ready to go into coalition with Fine Gael. Now, you know, he had really expressed that view, but not probably as boldly and in such a kind of a, you know, a firm way. And I think what he wanted to do was maybe put a bit of pressure on Fine Gael, but unfortunately the pressure actually has ended up being on himself, because this seems to have galvanised quite a lot of the, say, various councillors and local grassroots who have now been in touch to say, under no circs are we to go, you know, we did confidence apply and look where that got us. We lost 8 seats, so we were not ready to countenance a grand coalition. And you see, this is the danger, I think, with these prolonged talks, particularly when there's a lot of sniping between the main parties. What it does, it actually entrenches the opinions of the grassroots, to which all the main parties are going to have to bring, in the unlikely event a programme for government is put together, well, hopefully, but it's not looking great at the moment. You know, they will have to bring them to their party members to basically seek permission to adopt this programme for government and go into government. And the more that the sniping goes on and the more instability within the parties, you know, like it's not quite a full heave, but there's rumblings, there's rustlings in the undergrowth of Fianna Fáil at the moment about Micheál Martin's leadership. The more that galvanises the grassroots to either one position or the other, which adds again to the difficulty of forming a government. So really what Micheál Martin, with the best intention in the world, did, all he's actually done is create more problems for himself, because, you know, all his party know that he is literally supping the last half of his pint in the Last Chance saloon at the moment, and this is his big chance to beat Taoiseach, and it ain't coming back if this one goes. So there's a feeling that Leo Varadkar is well aware of this and is playing hardball. If they are going to go into coalition, he wants to extract as many, you know, concessions from a weakened Micheál Martin.
The Greens too. Stories and of a rotating Taoiseach. And one year for the
Greens. I think they've actually vociferously denied that this has happened. But again, you know, they're having their leisurely talks, you know, with everybody. So there's a lot of talking, but not a lot of action.
Noreen, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, there's an interesting piece by Pascal Donoghue in the Sunday Independent, Why We Must Salvage the Political Centre or Face a Bleak Future. You know, and he's saying that politicians must deliver a more inclusive form of well-being and prosperity. And an interesting line, that the public good must always precede private interests. And I'm not sure that that would necessarily have been the message from the electorate just 4 weeks ago. You know, I think it's a very, I think Jaleesa's point, and she's much more expertise in this than I do, she's much closer. I think it's a really intractable, very difficult situation. And there are massive cultural differences in Ireland between the two civil war parties, if you want to call them that. I mean, we talk ideologically about how there isn't a huge difference. But actually, in terms of the culture of the parties, there is. And I think that's going to be a really hard thing to put together. Michael Brennan has a piece that Fianna Fáil finds itself snookered as options for coalition diminish in the Sunday Business Post. So I don't know that we're going to find a grand coalition out of this, because one of the two parties other than Sinn Féin will probably savage each other in the process. The notion that we're going to have a 5-year deal, that means, you know, you keep Sinn Féin in the opposition benches for that time, is that realistic? The Greens, as we mentioned, who really are the kingmakers in this, and will obviously want to have a lot of concessions to their policies and to what they're seeking for the period in government. And then Sinn Féin, which is, they're still campaigning. They're still, you know, they're 10% up in the last opinion poll. I thought it was a very interesting piece by Neil Francis in the Sunday Independent Sports section today, and I heard it advertised yesterday and I thought, oh, I've got to read that. And essentially the headline is Sinn Féin policy would hurt education system. Mm-hmm. And the point he's making is that of the 52 private schools in the country, if this subvention is taken out, rugby is ruined. Now, I'm not sure that that would get much traction with the electorate in the current climate. So I think there's an awful lot of competing agendas at the moment. And I, as an outsider, find it very difficult to see how we're going to come to some sort of a deal, particularly in the climate that we're in with coronavirus, COVID-19. And I wonder if we're just going to be back in a general election in a couple of months.
The Sunday Times, I think, or one of the papers is saying that's not we're going to
end they were just saying that that would be very unwise, any second general election, simply because it involves politicians kissing babies and shaking hands. It's really probably not the wisest.
Just on the government formation, I don't think the political system has kind of absorbed how big a situation this is. That if things go the wrong way, we're looking at a very difficult budgetary situation for the next government. Now, who wants to take on a period of austerity? Okay, politicians need to think. You know, they all went in saying they were going to dole out stuff and how the cake was going to be divvied out. There may be no cake there. And that's a very different political prospect. And anyone who's thinking about going into government needs to say, OK, we may be looking at a period of austerity after we've dealt with the health crisis. Do you want to be presiding over another period of austerity? Think long and hard about that.
Peter, I know your position is apolitical now. You came from Fianna Fáil, but you're limited in what you can say. But can you give us any insight into, you know, what Fianna Fáil members might think around all of this, or what are your thoughts on it?
You're correct, Sarah, in that. But I mean, I can give you an insight into what virtually every TD is thinking about this.
Go for it.
And that is, they will not want another election. The amount of seats that were won in this general election very late in the night by very, very small margins was very, very large. And those TDs are sitting very uncomfortably in their seats in Tall Éireann. And I know what that experience is like. So the pressure will come, and they have a disproportionate amount of pressure in this whole process. The backbench TDs will not want to go on the doorsteps, nor does the country need another general election. And I would go back to the very, very interesting piece again by Pascal Donoghue. It's a staunch, passionate defence of the centre of Irish politics, and whatever, you know, part of the spectrum one comes from, or no matter what way one voted in the general election, he's pointing to quite a simple truth in all of this, that almost half of the public voted for the centre. And if that happened in any other country in Europe, certainly in liberal democracies, there's your government, that it points to that. I'm not saying, I'm not advocating for that, because that's a political matter, but that's the position he's holding in this article.
But equally, could the argument be that almost half the country voted left, or a lot of them voted left?
And if that can coalesce, absolutely, if that can coalesce around a coherent government that's stable and that can, that has the political authority to deal with these very serious issues of housing, health and climate change, they should coalesce now and form a government quickly. But it is an interesting point that the policies of the centrist parties, including centrist independence, seemed to hold that sort of major ground. The other, I suppose, very interesting article is one, you know, typically provocatively by Owen Harris. And you know, he's pointing to the fact that leaders, they know, they're experienced people. They know what the result of the election is, And they know that the pressure is on now to form a government rather than have the second election, as has been suggested.
Do you think, though, that you know, like people who voted for Sinn Féin are looking at this and going, why won't Fianna Fáil talk to Sinn Féin? Why won't Fine Gael talk to Sinn Féin? They're ruling it out immediately without even going into discussions about it. And I think people are feeling insulted by the way the government is behaving at the moment and the way all the political parties are behaving. There's no sense of urgency. There's no sense of, you know, getting heads together and making this happen. And I think, you know, there's, as the last opinion poll in the Sunday Times showed, you know, support for Sinn Féin just went up in that period.
Well, it's a narrative they're very good. Sinn Féin are very adept at propagating as well, not without just some justification, of course. I was at one of their rallies down in Cork, I think it was the first one. And, you know, they're very much of the, you know, we've been left out of the talks, you know, we're the outsiders. And this is something they've excelled at doing as a political party over the years, and, you know, watching them in action as very effective opposition. It's, you know, nobody were excluded from decisions, and it's always the big two, the big two, the big two.
It is true, though, isn't it?
Oh, they are being said without justification, absolutely. Sure. But they're very good at making this a rallying point for all their the new disillusioned, disaffected people out there that feel that they haven't been looked after by governments of the big of the other big two, the parties known formerly as the big two, and they're very good at.
What do you make of that pressure coming on Martin, Micheál Martin, within his own party in relation to Sinn Féin specifically? Again, a lot of the piece in the paper today talking about how TDs are saying, you know, they made the decision too early to rule out Sinn Féin. That shouldn't, that decision shouldn't have been made. Eamon O'Queeve gave an interview earlier in the week.
Yeah.
It was a small number, probably still is a small number. But do you think that Micheál Martin might find himself pushed in that direction a bit more?
Well, it's yeah, I mean, it is possible because, you know, Eamon O'Queeve was one of the very early dissenters very early came out of the traps on this and said that we were, you know, it was for the red lines were thrown down far too quickly. And then Micheál Martin, of course, doubled down on this in the first day back in the Dáil, where he gave that, he excoriated Sinn Féin and Mary Lou MacDonald, the leader, you know, from his seat. Instead of, you know, maybe opening the doors, he shut them firmly and actually threw the bolts over. But of course, goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that the longer this goes on, the more the debate happens within the party, the more, you know, TDs are going home to their constituencies and they're hearing opinions from grassroots, and the more confused it becomes. I don't think it has critical mass yet, possibly because, as you mentioned in what it says when you're going through the headlines, you know, Jim McCallaghan is reportedly under some pressure, but there's no obvious contender to step into Micheál Martin's shoes, which might be why the various daggers are staying in their scabbards. But, you know, again, you know, the party is in a state of turmoil, which is not a great, you know, way to be going into these talks.
Dan? Yeah, let's just be clear. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael both ruled out coalition with Sinn Féin as election promises. They did that for very serious reasons. Across Europe, there are parties that do not have full commitment to democratic values. There are serious questions about Sinn Féin. Who controls it, how it's funded, how it deals today with people that were murdered by the IRA, who were raped by members of the IRA. These are extremely serious matters.
Mm. Well, yes, you have those concerns, but I know that Eamon O'Queeve, for example, again, in his interview with Sean O'Rourke earlier this week, said he doesn't have concerns about that he works very closely with a lot of distant Republicans in the North, and he's very aware of the situation on the ground. And he's very content, for example, that the Sinn Féin is not being controlled by shadowy figures, or at least not any more than Fianna Fáil is being controlled by unelected officials.
To play devil's advocate as well, you know, you could argue that the people who voted for Sinn Féin were aware of all of these things, but still made that decision. And certainly I know the moment I knew that I thought Sinn Féin were going to do much better than predicted was when I listened to younger groups of people all under 40 talking about the housing issue. And they weren't voting for Sinn Féin for ideological reasons. They were voting for Sinn Féin because they're in jobs, they're being paid, and they're living in these awful places where your feet stick to the carpet as you go to your single bedroom that you're paying a grand a month for. So I think they are important considerations as well. So, you know, I think it's a much bigger debate, but it was shut down very early on in the process. And now we're at what it seems to be an impasse. That there is no obvious way forward.
And one of the difficulties, Chris, from a non-political point of view, as a sort of civilian, I mean, I look at the way the RIC controversy blew up just before the election and how it seemed to nudge the electorate towards the Sinn Féin vote. And, you know, Noreen saying, you know, there's no, you know, there's barely a cigarette paper between the two civil war parties. And yet we're dealing with an RIC thing which goes back 100 years. So I think the Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil thing is ultimately a tribal Montague and Capulet sort of thing. And that's why we must never ignore history.
It's also interesting the commentary coming from, you know, from the parties in the North as well, kind of saying, you know, do the parties, you know, are Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil speaking with forked tongue? You know, they are at the same time, you know, advocating, you know, that they worked hard for the restoration of the executive in Stormont, and the two parties, the DUP and Sinn Féin, to go back into government there, or, you know, and at the same time they're saying they're not fit for government down here. Now, I know that there's a difference between, people say there's a difference between an evolved, basically regional executive and a sovereign, you know, government. But again, it's just interesting that there is a lot of chatter coming down, you know, from the north of Ireland saying, you know, you can't have it both ways, guys. You can't sort of say that Sinn Féin should be in power, you know, across the border, and deny them an opportunity down here.
Well, I think that we need to make a very clear distinction. Whatever the flaws of this state, it existed as a functioning democracy for 100 years. When you have a broadly well-functioning democracy, you don't take risks with your democracy. Northern Ireland is more akin to a failing Central American state, and it has been for 100 years. To get from that to a functioning democracy, you do need to bend the rules. So there is I was absolutely in favour of the Good Friday Agreement. Bringing extremists like the DUP and Sinn Féin into government was a route to taking it from a failing state to a better functioning democracy. In this jurisdiction here, we can be proud of our state, and we need to be careful about taking risks with democratic values.
But our democracy voted Sinn Féin the most number of seats. That's the reality.
In Germany, very large numbers of people vote for the alternative for Germany party. None of the other parties will touch it because of historical legacy issues, which go back a lot further in time than the issues we're dealing with. Nobody accuses anybody of the alternative for Germany party of being involved in murder. It is the ideology, the history of those people that the other parties won't touch.
No, and they're very legitimate concerns, but we're in a situation where there's one political party that got the most seats that's out of the process for forming government.
I think Noreen's point is right. I think that I think a lot of people lent Sinn Féin their vote this time, parked their problematic past, and said that they have promised that they will deal with health and housing. And I think the vote's on loan.
All right. Well, lots of people texting in on this and other issues. 51551. We'll get to some of those after the break.
The Weekend on One on RTE Radio 1.